We are back and better, and with another episode of the Dream Shakers podcast. I'm your host, George Nunez, alongside here with my co-host,
Stephon Odom.
And today we have the pleasure of speaking with Shalom Osiadi. Shalom was born in Nigeria and raised in Ireland, has a bachelor's and MBA from Dublin City University. He has had previous experiences at Next Group, Shahu, River Island, Paddy Power, Irdero, Electric Ireland, and Service Source. He also is very entrepreneurial and enjoys building things. He was previously the founder of See Me Build, Euro Foundation, Glow Up, and now he is the founder / CEO of Aska Menus. Welcome to the show, Shalom.
Thank you guys very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, 100%.
For sure, thanks, brother. Guys. How are you feeling? Like, what's going on? How's everything in Ireland? And I know that, you know, you're actually the first person we ever had on the show who is international. So how is it out there?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an unusually sunny day in Ireland, usually quite gray. But it's a beautiful day here. I even have to have the fan on, it's that warm. But definitely a nice day here in Ireland.
Yeah, fair point, man. Now let's get into it. How was it growing up in Ireland with an African household or African culture?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I think in every immigrant household, there is that slight disconnect between the culture that is within the home and then the culture that the child or, you know, family experiences once they step out the front door. And it was no different with us, you know. I come from a background of fairly strict parents, you know, very Nigerian African culture of do this, don't do this, and, you know, get straight A's, all that kind of stuff. But then you were kind of thrown into this culture of, you know, liberal freedom and, you know, don't hit your kids and everybody can do whatever they want kind of thing. And that was a little bit of it took some getting used to. But I think it's definitely something a lot of immigrants, children, especially first generation immigrants, have faced at some stage. It was a lesson, definitely a blessing and a lesson, but it's made me who I am today, you know. I guess that's probably what I can say at the moment.
And given that varied background, right, those differences in terms of what was happening in the home and what was happening in society more generally, how did you ultimately decide that you were going to carve a path for yourself into technology? Like, what was that process like?
Yeah, I'll be perfectly honest. Between the ages, so I moved to Ireland, I had just turned 10, I believe. And, you know, at the time I had zero goals or aspirations outside of I want to just live and go to school and enjoy this new life that I have now, you know. You know, so my mother specifically worked very, very hard. And I remember at the time all I thought about was just being able to help my mom make more money, you know, because she was at the time the, you know, she was the primary breadwinner in the home. And, you know, she was the one that carved the path to us being here. And everything that she did, I kind of looked up to and resonated with. Like, this is kind of who I want to be when I grow up. And also, you know, what can I do now to help her get to the next step of where she's trying to go in this journey of hers, you know? Because I don't think it needs to be said, it's very difficult being a you know, primary breadwinner in a family of, you know, four, living in a foreign country and, you know, having all these different expenses fly at you. But, you know, at the time, my primary technology wasn't even in my mind. I think we got a computer in my home when I turned 11 going on 12. That was the first time we ever owned a computer. I had interacted with computers when I was in primary school in Nigeria, actually. I was, you know, lucky enough to go to a private school in Nigeria. Technically, everybody in Nigeria goes to a private school because the public school system is, you know, terrible. You know, had this computer school or class that we go to, and I remember making my email address, and even till today, the email address I used is the one I made when I was, you know, 9 years old. And it has a triple W in front of it because I thought that's how all email addresses were supposed to be, you know, because you go on the internet, you see www dot, and I was like, okay, that's so, I just made my email address like that. So that was my first experience with a computer. And then my mother bought this computer when we were, you know, I'd moved to Ireland. And I, you know, again, the strict household thing was like, the internet is like a no-no, right? Oh, you're going to use the internet. It has to be fully supervised. You have to, it's only, you can only use it for X amount of time in a day. And, you know, so there was all these restrictions and stuff. But obviously me being me, I'm very tenacious, especially when I want to do something. And I, as I said, that experience with the computer when I was younger, you know, kind of left something in me. And I didn't realize it resonated with me until my mother bought that PC we had at home. So I'd go on it every so often and, you know, kind of just play around, play some games and stuff. And then obviously going into school, all my friends, you know, they all had computers, their families used the internet all day, every day. And then social media started to pop up, especially this, there was this social media site, especially in Ireland, called Bebo, right? And it was kind of like a child version of like Facebook or what it is now. You know, that was all the rage in school. And I remember kind of, that was my first experience at really social media and going on the internet and stuff. But prior to that, it was all just playing games and, you know, really being a kid on the internet. There was no, in my head at the time, there was no financial gain or even, you know, growth or career path. I mean, I was 11 years old. You know, my 30 minutes a day, I played games and then I left. So sorry, I guess I kind of got off topic. To get back to your point about how did this actually get me to tech, you know, it didn't really happen until I was about 13. And I was in secondary school at the time. And, you know, music for me, it was always a big part of my life. It still is till today. And I remember listening to certain songs, you know, especially when I go to school, my friends would play these songs, and I would absolutely fall in love. And I was like, this is great, you know. Backstory to that, again, in my house, we weren't, myself and my sister, we weren't allowed to listen to like secular music, right? So it was kind of like, if it's not gospel music, it's not in this house. So obviously going to school and, you know, hearing 50 Cent and Eminem and all these, I was like, wow, okay, this is lit. So I'd come home and then I started to try and find ways to get this music for myself. And I remember I won some award in school where I got an MP3 player as part of it, right? That was the first time I ever owned like an actual like device. And I didn't know how to, you know, before this was all CDs. So what I started to do was, you know, I tried to burn some CDs unsuccessfully. And then when I got this MP3, I realized there was a way for me to actually get my own music onto this little device. So I started trying to experiment with like LimeWire and, you know, all these other little tools. What's this another one? Napster, to try like actually download all this cool music I'd heard from my friends. And that was kind of where my intrigue with computing actually started. It was through music. And then that kind of just developed into what it is now, really. From music, it turned into production. And then from production, it turned into websites and coding. And it just kind of spiraled like that until I kind of got to the age of 15, where the monetization aspect came in. And then that was where it just kind of just skyrocketed from there.
That makes all the sense. And I'm going to hand it back to George right now. But when you said LimeWire, I immediately connected because, you know, my family was coming to me to put the music on all the devices through the LimeWire. And this was before.
LimeWire was it, man. Yeah. Like when we had them MP3s, my God. And you wanted to download that music? LimeWire was the place to go. RIP, yeah. LimeWire, man. That was.
Bro, for real. LimeWire made my teenage years, I have to say. It really did.
Without a doubt. Same here. Like, you know, it was the whole gospel thing in the crib. You couldn't really listen to that kind of music. So once I was able to you know, hack the system and, you know, figure out a way to finesse around my mom's. I was good to go on the way to school. Yep. Yeah, it was game on. I was yep. tuned in to all the two. Yep.
shouts out to Young Draco, aka Soulja, who was the first artist to hack the algorithms and was all over LimeWire. All over LimeWire.
Big Soulja, man. Oh my God. That's a deviant. And so, you know, wanted to ask you, right, because you are a person, and from us looking at your background to you talking a bit about it, like, sounds like you are a strong advocate or proponent of education. So talk about what education has done for you, what made you go off to school, and what made you pursue that MBA? Like what did the MBA do for your career?
So the MBA, I'm still in the process of it, believe it or not. I've got my dissertation is due at the end of this month, I believe. But I guess education altogether was because you have to. And then as I grew, it was because I wanted to learn more about things I was interested in. So from the ages of like 13 to 16, I wanted to be a doctor and then a lawyer, and then it turned into sort of tech by the time I was 17 or thereabouts. And the reason was, when I was 15, I got the opportunity to start up my first sort of online business, thanks to a family friend and my parents. And that was where the love of tech sort of settled for me. And that was when my whole idea of, oh, do law or medicine because you'll make a lot of money, turned into, nah, I actually enjoy this tech thing. I'm going to try and pursue that. So I chose that to go to college with, got my course, and then I've been on pretty much a steamroll into corporate life since then. So education for me became a tool to empower my wants and needs rather than something that I just did for the sake of it, because that was what it was up until the age of maybe 16, 17, you know. And I mean, in terms of the MBA, my hope for that is that it'll lead me to the right areas of the career that I'm chasing. But, you know, and I'm going to be fully honest, now that I'm this age, older and wiser, as they say, I mean, I don't really think it's going to be a little bit controversial, but I, you know, now that I'm doing all this stuff and I've gotten up to this stage with education, I don't really think it is necessary as much. And why am I saying that? I think it's important for us to differentiate between a degree and a career. A degree can get you into the right career or the career that you're looking for, but experience will put you in the right positions within that career faster. And I guess that's where the differentiation comes in. But it's done a lot for me on paper. But again, I know people that are way ahead of me in their careers and they barely have an undergraduate degree. So
now, given that additional piece of context, you also have been able to build those experiences though, right? Because you've co-founded startups previously, right? So can you detail more about that experience and also what keeps you eager to come back again and again and again?
Great question. Again, it's my original love for tech. And my love for tech, or the love I have now as concrete as it is, came from business, right? So as I said, I started my first online business at 15, an online business. And those two have always tied together for me. And that's where really the passion, if you would like, to go from co-founding startup to startup has come from. Again, you know, being fully open and honest, 90% of all the startups I've done in the past have failed. And the reason is, when you have zero experience, zero advice, and zero capital, you're learning everything by yourself, you need to fail. You know what I mean? I don't know how to sort of make that clearer, but if you do not understand how failure works at the very early stages, it's very difficult to understand how to reach the sort of places that you are trying to go in terms of success. And for me, business always tied into technology. And that was where, even in my day jobs, I'm sitting there dreaming about my projects that I have going on the side. You know, so those two have always married for me. And that's kind of where that whole passion for it has come from. I've tried to, and believe me, I remember I was part of a project last year. You know, this team hired me to do some consulting work for them. I then ended up joining the team. And, you know, they raised quite a good bit of money. And all of a sudden, the team decided to quit because the workload was going to be too much post-investment. At that point in time, I looked at myself and I was like, I'm wasting my time. I need to go and just sit down behind a desk and work my way up the ladder like everybody else, you know. And I tried that. I really did try that. Within 2 weeks, I was bored. So when it's ingrained like that, it's very difficult to get rid of it. You know what I mean? And I guess it's just, that's just how it's been for me.
Wow, that's so dope, man. And so that is perfect because I wanted to ask you about Eska. Like how did that idea for the company come about? Why the name Eska Menus? Are you a foodie? Can you cook? Like, you know, we want to know it all. Like, how did it all come about?
Yeah, so Eska initially started as a digital menu. So I was exiting a business I was a part of in the UK. And a friend of mine came to me and was kind of like, he has this idea for this thing. And, you know, he pitched it to me and it was like, it was a digital menu. Right. I don't know if you guys are most likely familiar with them. You see them everywhere now. QR code, you scan, the menu comes up. Right. And that was all it was. And at the time, as I was exiting this business, I was kind of like, this sounds interesting. Because I was thinking, what about, okay, what's next? You know, go back to the job and just sit there. And, you know, I didn't really want to do that. And so when he came to me, I felt like it was kind of the right time. So I was like, cool, let's get it. So we started. We built this digital menu, started selling it, you know, reception was good until in Ireland, you know, we had like three different lockdowns. So lockdown number one hit, a lot of our, you know, customers left because they had to close their businesses. These are restaurants, cafes and bars, right? And then we just kept going and then things started to pick up again a little bit. And then all of a sudden, lockdown number two hit. And that just kind of wiped us out. And as this was happening, we started to realize the competition was just growing and growing and growing and growing and growing. And so we looked at it and we looked at the business, we looked at the market and we're like, number one, market's too saturated. Number two, you know, we've tried this twice now and our customers just keep leaving because, you know, their businesses are closing. How do we salvage this? And we did a little bit of digging. And by December, we had sort of come up with an idea of, you know, selling this menu to individuals. Right, specifically individuals who are doing cooking via social media. They don't have a way to efficiently take payments. They don't have a way to efficiently run their businesses outside of taking DMs and bank transfers and all that other stuff. So we started that and the reception kind of looked a little bit good. So by January, we said, look, let's rebuild this platform and optimize it to this new market. We did that. By February, we started sort of recruiting, if you would like, for our beta program, which we're still in at the moment. And by March, we started what we call our open beta. So we had budgeted for about 20, you know, cooks, right, to come onto this program. And by March, we had about 34. And we were kind of like, whoa, you know, this is insane. You know, like, we didn't expect this. And as the months went on, we kind of realized, okay, that there's definitely something here. And that's where Eska was born. It was really, in essence, we realized that there is such a barrier to entry between loving cooking, wanting to make money from cooking, and actually making money from cooking. You know, so many different steps in between all those levels. And with Eska, we really wanted to make a platform that got rid of all those barriers and just allowed someone with a passion for cooking to just say, cool, tomorrow I'm going to start a business. And that's literally how easy it is with Eska, you know? So that was really it. And, you know, things seem to be going well. And yeah, our mission is still the same. You know, we really want to lower those barriers to entry for food entrepreneurship. And that's the goal. And the name actually came about, I was just doing some research and came across this word in Latin that kind of signified, and that was what we decided to name the brand, was Eska.
And are you a foodie? And do you like to cook?
Yes, I am a massive foodie. A massive foodie. I am picky though. Like, if you're a foodie, you just eat anything. That's not me. I'm not. Like, if you give me something that I just, for example, I don't really like onions, boiled onions. No, you know, so for me, I am a picky eater, but I definitely try new foods, you know, all the time. Cooking, I'm a good solo cook. What that means is I can cook for myself. I make fantastic food that Shal loves in portions that Shal can handle. But anywhere outside of that, it's like, you know, but I definitely am a massive foodie. Actually, another bit of a backstory to the origins of Eska. When I was in college, because of my lack of cooking skills, all I did was order a takeaway. All day, every day. I got a nickname, actually, in my final year of college as Pizza Boy. My friends would come into my house and see boxes of pizzas lined around the house. This is not even a joke. This is for real, right? It got so bad that I was actually hospitalized for eating so much junk food. True story. Then a friend of mine who was quite good at like making African food and stuff offered to cook for me for a number of weeks just to help me get back on my feet when I got released from the hospital. Within like 6 weeks, I'd say, I was revived. I was eating better, saving more money, and, you know, generally just felt better. And I hadn't ordered a single meal off a takeaway for over a month. And at that time, I was like, this is, you got to do this. This is a business. You know, she was very wary of it at the time. Like, I don't really know. I don't know how to start a business, blah, blah, blah. But she ended up taking the leap anyway. And now she has like one of the largest Instagram food pages in Ireland. Sorry. And that was where, when we were looking to pivot, that was the first thing that came to my mind, was like, wow, she was able to do this. She helped me out so much. There's something here. And that was kind of the backstory behind the backstory of Eska as it is today. But yeah, I am a massive, massive foodie.
Now, a lot of the experiences your company has had has taken place in Ireland. This is where the company was formed. That makes all the sense in the world. When you look to the future, do you think there will be opportunities outside of Europe? Could you foresee an instance wherein this company was able to go across the pond, so to speak, and do work in the US?
Without a shadow of a doubt. Without a shadow of a doubt. I think it goes without saying, you know, Europeans are a lot more conservative than Americans. And I think a business like Eska would actually have more success in the US for a number of reasons. Open-mindedness, more diversity, more culturally authentic, and just better, it's a better environment altogether, you know, for a business like Eska to thrive. And we're in Ireland, obviously, because that's where I'm based, that's where I'm from, and that's where the business was born. But we definitely see ourselves outside of Europe at some stage, 100%. And, you know, there are businesses similar to ours thriving in parts of the US right now.
Absolutely. And elaborating off of Steph's question, what have you noticed within the food industry between like the US and Europe? And also, where are you at in terms of like raising capital, raising funding for your startup? And if you believe, if you truly believe that the US is more open towards your business, what has sort of like pushed you back from just going full force and just raising capital in the US and reaching out to American venture capital firms or US-based venture capital firms?
Yeah, these, again, hard-hitting, Very, very good questions. I'll try to take the first one. The industry, or the difference in the industry between Europe and America, is, again, it goes back to the mindset, right? Europe, very conservative. America, think big, do big, right? It's apparent in the portion sizes even that you get between the same meals here in Europe versus what you get in America. Number two, it goes back to the diversity I spoke about. America, ridiculously diverse, right? So you have the ability to have any kind of food from any nationality within reason that you want in the States. Whereas in Europe, extremely hard to find, right? And again, that goes back to the conservative nature of the mindset here in Europe and the massive barriers to entry for food entrepreneurship. In America, at the land of opportunity, as they say, you have an idea, you go for it. Now let's look at home cooking, right? Which is what Eske is centered around. You in America now have the ability in many states to just start a food business from your home, and it's a legitimate business. In Europe, you have similar rules, but again, a lot more restriction around how you do it, what you can do, and how much you can make. You know what I mean? And those, I think, are the primary differences between Europe and America when it comes to food. I mean, like, America with food, that's like, every time I think about it, like, specifically pancakes, right? I know this is a weird thing, right? Every time I think about pancakes, I think about IHOP. I don't know, maybe it's because of the movies or something, but I also think about chicken and waffles. Every time I think about stuff like that, America pops into my head. When I was 15, I had the chance to go to LA, and I have never seen plates of food this big in my life. I don't know what y'all put in your food, but the portions are ridiculous anyway.
Sometimes that's a problem we're still trying to figure out right now. You know, given the current, brother, it ain't all daisies over here. But go ahead.
But no, in all honesty, I love it. You know, I'm a massive foodie. And then the second part is, why did we not do this in the States? I guess with anything, right, business, career, etc., it's easier said than done. I could easily get up today and go to New York and say, cool, I'm here now, Eske, let's start it, let's go to the moon. But in reality, I need to do a number of things before I do that. Number one, I need to understand the market. I need to understand the landscape. I need to build a network. And then I need to hit the ground and see what it's actually like to make this thing feasible. All things that are very, very difficult to do when you have no idea what you're getting yourself into apart from what you've seen on television, right? It will take a lot longer to build Eske, I think, in the States than it would here. Although in the long term, it would definitely be more beneficial. My thinking right now is that it would just take longer because of the lack of knowledge I have of that space. It's easier here because I know people to talk to. I understand the market. I understand the needs. I understand the lack of the solution, you know, because the problem is there, but the solution is not. And I understand how Eske could fit into that in Ireland. But in the States, I have to reevaluate all those metrics, you know. And I guess that's where the main thing is. Now, the other question is, how are we doing in terms of funding? I mean, getting funding for any startup, as you guys probably know, is extremely difficult. But we've been lucky enough to receive about $155,000 now worth of funding. And are hoping to, you know, close off our round by, say, mid-November. But we've been definitely fortunate to sort of get that because, again, I don't think you guys, I need to say this, but raising money is hard. Raising money in Europe is harder. Raising money as a Black person in Ireland, in Europe, is monumentally difficult. You know, so we were definitely lucky in that regard. In fact, we actually had to go to the UK to raise most of those funds.
I'm going to keep it going right along. Now, this is another question around the business model of Eske. And what we wanted to understand was, you know, why did you opt for flat monthly pricing over an alternative method that saw Eske earn a percentage of each sale?
So again, slight correction. At the moment, we actually do we run a commission structure right now. We are, however, moving to a subscription-based model. Not fully sure when that's going to happen just yet, but the reason why we're going to do that is for a number of reasons. Food is a low margin business. And food from home cooks who are selling half, if not a quarter of what brick and mortar businesses are selling is an even lower margin business. So it's very difficult to make money, significant money, from a business that's making a quarter of what their competitors, who are the big guys, are making, right? So to put it into context, we can't charge 30% per transaction when this individual is only making a couple hundred a week, you know, like at the moment, you know what I mean? So a subscription model guarantees recurring revenue for us, and it leaves our cooks to focus on their businesses and really grow their businesses as much as they possibly can without eating too much into their revenue. Because realistically, why would you pay 30% commission per transaction when you can just stick to social media and hope for the best? You know, it doesn't really make much sense there. You know, if you were a restaurant or something, it's different, because if we could promise that we would bring you X amount of sales every month, that's a different ballgame because you're already making thousands a week. You know, but again, because you're a home cook, your margins are smaller, you can't serve at that scale. So we decided that it might be easier to do it this way. And then there was something else I was going to mention as well. Yeah, I lost my train of thought, guys, apologies. But I think definitely one of the main things was, you know, yes, as much as we are a for-profit business, we are trying to make an impact as well, you know, because wealth creation for me has always been one of my foundations in technology and how it can give people the ability to come out of the situations that they're currently in right now. And with Esca, we want to give people the ability to make money from their passions, you know, so we're not trying to, you know, take your money and run without giving you an opportunity to build a business. That's what it's about.
Now, we wanted to ask you about like regional cooking, your perspective. And as you know, it can be fairly difficult to come by, especially if you're not in a major metropolitan hub. How have you enticed local cooks to embrace the platform and provide more options or food options to local community members? And not only how have you enticed them, but how have you been able to retain them over time?
Great question. So right now, one major thing that we are trying to pursue is product market fit. And that's where, when you get to PMF, that's where you see your retainment levels steady and rise, right? At the moment, for us, it is a little bit choppy because, again, with a marketplace, you're trying to build two businesses at once. So we've been able to successfully build the demand. Now we're working on we've been able to build the supply side. Now we're really focusing on building the demand so that our customers or our cooks, essentially, can see the real benefits of being on Esca. Now, the problem with cooking in countries like Ireland, I should say, is that it's difficult to find local cuisine as an expat or an immigrant, right? It's very easy to go onto the, you know, Uber Eats of this world and find a pizza, burger, chips, chicken, all the generic stuff that you would see day to day. But say, for example, I'm Nigerian and I'm looking for, you know, jollof rice, for example. That is extremely hard to find, you know? So we've been able to entice cooks by saying, look, you come to our platform, we will get you customers that are looking for your food media. You understand what I'm saying? While giving you all these other perks like deliveries, you know, online payments, digital shopfront, stuff like that. And then for the foodies, it's the reasons I've just mentioned. I want to find food that I can't find on Uber Eats, for example. That's why I would come to Esca, because I know that as a Nigerian who's new to the country, and I'm looking to find some jollof rice, I will find it on Esko. So that has been our sort of unique selling point, you know, with Esko menu. Aside from the fact that it gives home cooks the ability to really monetize their passion for cooking. Because as I said, there's a massive chasm between knowing how to cook, making money from cooking, and building a business from cooking. With Esko, you cut through that noise and go from knowing how to cook to building a business. You know, so there are multiple reasons why cooks and foodies would come to us, but diversity is the major selling point for foodies, and then accessibility and, you know, growth really are the major selling points for the cooks.
Now, that makes a lot of sense. So let's actually pivot back to that chasm, right? At the moment, the platform is catered, it's geared towards these small regional cooks, right? We know, though, that they may not have had that exposure of running their own business. So what is the platform itself doing to ensure that the coaching is there for these small cooks to succeed, both as chefs and as business owners?
That's a very good question. And I guess one of the major things that we have already done, and keep in mind, Esko is only 6 months old right now, right? But we've already been able to build a network of highly curated professional cooks and chefs who can educate our current user base of cooks. So when we first initially launched, I think within the first couple of weeks, we actually had a webinar with a well-renowned cook in the UK who just so happened to have built a great business and won several awards for his cooking and his selling skills. And we brought him on to essentially educate our user base on how to optimize their businesses for success and for scale. And we plan to take it a step further by actually offering unique things, you know, like courses and all these sort of things that can actually teach and coach people how to grow and maintain a business. And this is in line with the webinars and coaching sessions that we already sort of have in place. So those things there really help these business owners understand how to keep their businesses afloat and what they would need to do in essence to build successful businesses. Now, it's important that I should note that you can get all the coaching and training in the world, but if you are not willing to put in the work of making sure that your business is sustainable and growing and, you know, really learning, then that's on you. Because sometimes I think even with education, you know, you have the odd person that goes to school and is like, well, I didn't really learn anything. It's like, well, did you apply yourself? You know, did you do the work? And that's where the difference comes in. We can offer all the webinars and things as much as we want every day, but the reality is these things don't really mean much if they are not being taken into full consideration by those that they're given to, you know? So I guess that's where it is at the moment. But we definitely are doing a lot and have way, way, way more plans to do more in the future.
As the company continues to scale, and kitchens continue to grow, is there an interest in also integrating with wholesalers, with Esko Menu earning a small commission from each purchase so that cooks have the ability to get ingredients and products at more competitive price points?
It's like you guys, did someone send you our business plan? I'm looking at an email right now from one of our team that we're going to be sending out next week to wholesalers to provide that exact service to our cooks. Because we realized that one of the main things that kind of is another barrier to entry a lot of the times is the low margins of food, especially when you're working with such ethnic foods, you know, for some of our cooks that cost a lot of money. When you talk about importing to, you know, import fees and all that kind of stuff, the prices on some of these ingredients are quite, you know, extravagant. So working with wholesalers and, you know, these store owners, etc., to provide our cooks with better prices. Like that's, as I said, I'm looking at an email as we speak. So it's definitely a core part of our strategy. But, you know, that's, again, we're going to build on that as time goes on. But right now, our primary focus is finding PMF. That's the North Star right now. Then we can add all the other bells and whistles on. But we are definitely actively working on that.
No worries, brother. It seems like you guys are on the right path. And again, that's that strategy consultant and investment banking coming back in to really ensure that we got the full view of the business. So with that, we're going to go ahead and navigate into the final question. So here at Dream Shakers, you know, we're about paying it forward. We're about giving back. And one of the things that we want to ensure happens is that our audience is able to grow with us through these conversations. So what are three pieces of advice that you would give your younger self?
Ha. Don't stop. Number one. Invest more in yourself. Number two. And number three is knock on every door. Those are the three pieces of advice I would give myself. When I say don't stop, I mean, if you have a concept or an idea that you have in the back of your mind, and maybe you've actually gone and tried it and you've hit a stumbling block, call it maybe 6 to 8 months in. Some people don't even get that far. You've hit a stumbling block and you feel like this isn't going anywhere. I'm wasting my time. Do not stop. Unless you have clear signs that it is not working, right? There's a difference between hitting your head against the wall and, you know, stopping short of the finish line because you just don't feel like you can go any further. If you are going and you do see signs of momentum, just because you haven't hit that benchmark that you set in your mind doesn't mean that you should pack it in. And then number two is definitely invest more in yourself. Learn as much as you possibly can about as much as you possibly can. I always have to say that, you know, I have this saying, obviously a lot of people have it, but, you know, if you're a jack of all trades, you're a master of none. And in some ways it's true, but in other ways as well, it can be counterintuitive because a lot of people that I know how to do a lot of things well. But it is the ones that know how to do one thing really, really, really well that are extremely successful. And that's one thing I would tell my younger self is invest in one thing. Learn the hell out of that. Just keep going on that one thing and then see where it leads you. And then the final one is knock on every door. And then this ties back into the don't stop, right? If you continuously grind and grind and grind and you're just like, I'm literally getting nowhere. I don't know if you've seen those pictures of like this guy's like a little animated picture, this guy like digging a hole and then he decides to stop and walk back up the thing because he's digging for diamonds and he's just digging and he doesn't see any diamonds. But he doesn't realize that if he had just kept digging by like 2 more inches, he was going to hit literally a diamond mine, right? It's the same thing on this. Knock on every door. Ask as many questions as you can to anybody that you can. Find as many people that are doing what you want to do or have done what you are trying to do and ask them questions. This goes back to confidence as well. I had a very, very big issue with this when Eska initially started. I had never done sales before. But yeah, here I was picking up the phone every day, cold calling restaurants every single day. That was daunting for me, especially when you're hearing multiple no's on a daily basis. Like that hits your confidence, you know, but you just have to keep going and keep going and keep calling and keep calling and just knock on every single door. So that's what I would definitely advise my younger self and anybody who is in a similar position to me at a younger age, even now. I'm saying these things even talking to myself. So, yeah.
We appreciate you, Shalom. We appreciate the gems and jewels that you've been able to share. And it really means a lot, man, to come on and spend some time to kick it with us. share your journey. I'm sure the audience and the people tuning in will love the story and take so much from this conversation. So thank you again.
Thank you guys, yeah, for having me on, and I love the podcast, man.